You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink, inspiring public curiosity about food. Learn more at MOFAD.org.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, and creative people doing interesting things in food. I'm your co-host, Ethan Frisch, and sadly, Jenny is not with us this week. She's off cooking for some glamorous and amazing event. And I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm going to apologize if I'm sniffing in the background. But I'm really, really happy to introduce you to Lisa Curtis, who is the CEO and founder of Cooley Cooley Foods. Lisa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you have a company with a name that most people won't recognize, and the product that you carry is also something that a lot of people are not going to recognize. Can you just give us an introduction? What is Cooley Cooley, and what's your product?
Yeah, so Cooley Cooley is the first company to pioneer this nutritious green called moringa. So it's actually the leaves of this tree that grows all over the tropics, and it's, you know, eaten all over from Africa to South America to Southeast Asia, but just hasn't quite made it to the U.S. yet. And it's so nutritious and so amazing and can do so much to help improve nutrition and health in the places that it's sourced, and do the same here in America. So we're bringing it here.
And you came across Moringa yourself as a Peace Corps volunteer. Tell us that story.
Yeah, so almost a decade ago, I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Niger, West Africa, and I was in this super rural village with no electricity, no running water, and not a lot of healthy food. And I'm a vegetarian, so, you know, found my options were really rice, millet, and meat, and I didn't eat meat, so I was just eating rice and millet, and that diet left me feeling really weak all the time. I was just so tired, and at the time, I was volunteering at my village's health center, and so I turned to some of the nurses there and said, you know, hey, what can I eat to make me feel better? And they pulled these leaves off a tree, and they mixed it into this popular West African peanut snack called Cooley Cooley, so a little foreshadowing there. And they handed it to me and said, eat this. It'll make you feel better. And I'd never eaten tree leaves before. I'd never heard of moringa. I wasn't, you know, as into food as medicine as I am now. But it had a really powerful effect on my body, and I got hooked. And, you know, fast forward a few years later, I'm still doing it.
And what did it taste like? Or what was your impression the first time that you had it?
Yeah, so it tastes kind of like matcha. It has kind of this like green, earthy flavor. And it mixed really well with kind of these nuts. And it was one of those snacks where you eat it and you like feel good that you ate it. You know, it just like made you feel healthier.
Is it something that is traditional in Niger or in West Africa? What are some of the traditional preparations?
Yeah, so it often is mixed with this Cooley Cooley snack, and sort of eaten that way. What I found though was that often people weren't eating it in my community, or if they were eating it, they were taking the leaves and boiling them for hours and hours and then dumping out all the water. So it was leaching the majority of the nutrients. And it was kind of like moringa was like kale of 10 years ago. It was like this backyard weed that like people like didn't really know about. It wasn't a valuable crop. They didn't see any real, you know, reason to grow it and cultivate it. And so when I started, you know, when I got hooked on moringa and I looked around, I was like, I'm in one of the most malnourished countries in the world, and I'm reading about this plant that is arguably one of the most nutritious plants in the world. Why is nobody eating it? And started to talk to people, and they basically were like, oh, it's, you know, it's a poor person's crop. We'll eat it if we have to, but, you know, we're not going to eat it if we don't have to. And so long story short, I was like, how can I get you to eat it? Like, what will make you grow it? And they're like, well, help us sell it, and then we'll grow it. And if we grow it, we'll eat it.
Where do you think that association came from, the association of moringa with poor people?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes from the fact that moringa is one of the plants that grows year-round. And in a lot of countries that struggle with food insecurity, you have what you call the hunger season, which is when the food from the last harvest is running out and the food, you know, you haven't done the next harvest. And so there's not a lot of food. And moringa is one of those plants that grows year round. And, you know, especially during that hunger season, is a plant that a lot of people turn to sustain them. So I think that's where it comes from.
And did you start bringing it back, or what was the process to take it from, you know, having tasted it in Niger as a Peace Corps volunteer to then now having a company of a significant size,
yeah,
being in supermarkets across the country?
It was kind of a crazy ride.
I can imagine.
So I, you know, was like, oh, moringa, awesome. Okay, I'll help you sell it. Initially, the idea was really to just help some of these women's groups I was working with, help them sell it in a local city. And so we had, you know, started growing more moringa at the community health center with the idea of, let's do a lot of nutrition education around it and show people how to grow it, how to use it, and then they can earn money selling it locally. And that all sounded like a great old plan. And then about 7 months into my Peace Corps service, there was a terrorist attack. And so within 48 hours, Peace Corps Niger had entirely evacuated and we were forced to leave. And basically I was forced back to America, kicking and screaming, being like, I want to stay here. I want to do this thing. And, you know, like a lot of millennials, ended up in my childhood bedroom.
We've all been there.
Went grocery shopping with my mom and kind of looked around and I was like, you know, 10 years ago, like nobody was eating quinoa. Like, wasn't it just 5 years ago that like chia was for pets? Yeah. Like why not moringa?
Yeah.
Can I do this? And, you know, I think ignorance is bliss. I had no idea how hard it was to start a food company. So I just set my mind to I'm going to help these women sell moringa here in the largest market for superfoods in the world.
So once you'd made that decision, what were some of the first steps? How did you decide what to do next?
Yeah, so I made it kind of my job to just like talk to everyone I could. And I worked for like sort of, you know, worked for money and then also like volunteered for some different food companies to just try to understand like, how does this work? I found some friends who are smarter and better at food stuff than I am. And one of them at the time was actually working for like a consumer packaged good consulting firm, helping like Hershey's and General Mills and all these big companies like test out new product ideas. And I was like, can we do that, but with zero budget? She was like, yeah. Yeah, we could do that. So we started out in farmers markets. You know, in like we first was our home kitchen, then we got a commercial kitchen making everything by hand.
What were you making?
Well, that was the thing. We first were like, okay, do we make this like coolie coolie ball? Can we like do that? And we're like, that's actually kind of hard to make. And then figured out, okay, bars, people know what bars are. Like that might, you know, they don't know what moringa is. Like you said, they don't know what coolie coolie is. At least they know what a bar is and what to do with a bar. So let's make that. So started making bars, tested it in farmers markets. And actually, I think it was one of the more brilliant things we did because we were able to iterate so quickly on the recipe. It was like
making stuff in your
kitchen.
Making
stuff in our
kitchen. You can change the recipe every week.
Yeah, and, you can change it all the time. And we actually did what they call like shotgun surveys. So everybody who came by, we marked down their demographics. You know, did they like it? What they like about it? Did they not like it? What they say? And then did they buy it? And we were able to measure our conversion rate.
Wow. That's pretty sophisticated
for a
very early stage operation.
Totally.
What was some of the early feedback that you got?
You know, it was super interesting. So I am a bleeding heart Peace Corps volunteer. And I was like, everybody's going to want to know that this helps women in Africa and plants all these moringa trees and is like so good for the world. And they can just buy this product and like feel good about their life. And that is not what everybody wanted to know. Everybody wanted to know, what does this do for me? You know, how nutritious is it? Like, you know, tell me about like how it's going to make me feel better. And so I learned pretty quickly that having a social mission is important, but that people do not go into the grocery store looking for which product has the best social mission. They go into the grocery store looking for the product that's going to fulfill them in some way.
Yeah, I had a similar awakening starting the spice company and bringing spices to restaurants, to chefs, wanting to talk about the origin, the sourcing. We get this from shepherds in the mountains of Afghanistan. We bought this from a single farm in Guatemala, and they didn't care about that at all. It was like, it does it taste good, and is it cheap? I mean, wholesale is a different market than selling to consumers, but a similar realization. So how did you find ways to fold in that social mission to the messaging that you were
And the thing I realized, it's not that consumers don't care, right? I think they fundamentally do care, but I think they care once they're already bought in on the product. And so what we found was that people would try it and they'd be like, oh, this is pretty good. And this was like really different. What is this? And we're like, well, actually, it's more nutritious than kale. And they're like, what?
Nothing is more nutritious than kale.
And we're like, no, really, we have an infographic. It's really good. It'll show you exactly how we win. And then we would tell them, and it's a complete plant protein. So it's really good if you're eating a plant-based diet. And they're like, oh, okay. Oh, that's cool. And then we'd be like, and, you know, once they buy it, and also by purchasing this product, you're helping small women farmers in West Africa improve their lives and the lives of their community. And they're like, that's awesome. I'm going to tell my friends about it. And we're like, you do that. So I think we got more of a virality behind our brand because of the mission and because people felt good about what they had just purchased and then wanted to tell everyone else.
Do you think it was easier because they had never heard of Moringa before? You were starting with a blank slate, essentially, or was it harder because you had an ingredient that nobody had ever heard of?
I think it was harder. Okay. There were a lot of days where I'm like, why didn't I just start a chocolate company? Yeah. People would just know what it is. They would like it immediately. It would be so easy. But, you know, then I have friends who start chocolate companies. They're like, yeah, I'm one of like 5,000 chocolate companies. We're pretty unique, so that
And
helps.
At that point, how were you sourcing? How had you been able to set up supply chains?
So originally the goal was to source from Niger, where I was working, and so had this awesome women's group, you know, of some women in my village and some women in surrounding villages, and said, can we buy Moringa from you? And they said, yes, you can buy Moringa from us. The challenge was
there are a lot of challenges.
I was gonna say there was one challenge. No, there's like 5 million challenges. But the biggest challenge was they were producing at a very small scale, and so when they exported, we actually found we were paying more in shipping than we were for the Moringa.
I know that feeling,
which was heartbreaking. And then the other thing was just they were doing it at a village level, and at a village level, it's like totally normal to, you know, put the leaves out on your mat in the sun in the same place where there are goats and babies and chickens and everyone walking by, and a lot of contamination. So the quality part was really hard. We couldn't get enough quantity and we couldn't get the right quality. And so I just started thinking about, okay, you know, what can I do to like get this business going? And then hopefully go back and be able to help them build out a full processing center to do this right. And found this amazing women's cooperative in Ghana that was already growing Moringa. They were selling in like one store in New York and, you know, didn't kind of know much about the U.S. market, but really, really wanted to grow and scale. And they had great quality Moringa. So it was like kind of a match made in heaven. We were like, great, we'll be like the sales and marketing arm. And you keep doing what you're doing and growing this amazing, impactful Moringa.
How did you find them?
The internet.
Amazing.
Yeah. It was crazy. We just like, you know, we were just trying to Google around and like, it's a small little Moringa world. There's not that many people doing it. And especially in 2014, there was like nobody doing it. So we just found it was this, you know, Ghanaian guy. And he was like, yeah, and I'm working, you know, with these women and I'm trying to help them launch in New York, but he had a day job and like two kids and was like, I can't really do this. And I was like, well, I have no job and no kids and like, I want to do this. So I kind of started working with them there, and they were our only source of Moringa. We were just really fully focused on them for the first few years.
What happened?
Well, you know, they say you should diversify, and I know it never fully hit me like why you should do that until this was towards the end of 2015, and then we had just gotten our first big break. Whole Foods had just told us they wanted to launch us nationwide, which was amazing because we were a two-person team at the time.
And was that still the bars, the same product?
So that was, they wanted to launch, actually, good question. So we had launched the bars in 2014, and then in 2015, we launched the Pure Moringa Powder. And we did it as, we started out as kind of like an online test. I didn't know if people were going to know what to do with the powder. And, you know, it's like this earthy green powder, like, are people going to want this? And we got on somehow on MSNBC Morning Joe, which was amazing. And this was like a couple weeks after we had just put the Moringa powder, like thrown it up on our website, just test it out. And like all anybody ordered was the Pure Moringa powder. And so we were back ordered for like literally 4 months trying to get out all of this Moringa, but it taught us like, okay, maybe people want it. So then we started testing it in the stores in 2014/early 2015, and that went really well in just, you know, a few regions of Whole Foods. And so they then told us that they wanted to launch us nationwide in 2016. They wanted to launch the Moringa powder, and then we had a new product that we developed with them and then with the Clinton Foundation and this amazing organization called the Smallholder Farmers Alliance in Haiti. And that came about because they were looking for trees that could help reforest Haiti. And Moringa is an amazing, fast-growing tree. And by planting the tree and selling the leaves to us, they could both earn an income and provide reforestation. So, Wow. Yeah. So we created these energy shots made with that. So they're going to launch the energy shots and the powder nationwide. And then, like, 3 months before the whole farm in Ghana burned to the ground.
Oh, no.
There's this crazy wildfire, and I'll never forget, like, we were talking to this group like every couple days, and then all of a sudden they just like went totally silent, and we're like, what's going on? And so then I called them, and I finally got the woman who was the head of it on Skype. She was like, I'm so sorry, but everything has burned down. There was a huge wildfire. And she's like, go to Google Maps and like look. And you could like see, it was just like haze everywhere. The whole place was on fire.
Wow.
So that forced us to diversify.
Yeah. What did you do, and what did they do?
Yeah. So thankfully all the people were okay. It was just the field that had burned down. And so they were like, okay, we'll replant and, you know, we'll come back and you'll be able to source from us again. And we were like, great. Can't wait for that. But that was going to be, you know, at least a 6-month process. And so we started looking for other Moringa suppliers. And, you know, again, being millennials, it was like largely an internet search.
Google.
And we found this amazing family farm in Nicaragua. And it was an interesting moment for me because I had been so set on West Africa, so set on like women, and so set on cooperatives. And here was this organization that was none of those things, you know, based in South America, well, Central America, and had, you know, it was a family farm run by women and men, doing really good things, like paying above average wages. They like provided health care. They were working with all these small farmers from like all over the community. So doing great work. But they didn't fit my box of what an impactful supplier should look like. And it took a lot of kind of chats with like my co-founder and my mentors and just kind of to help me understand like, hey, maybe, you know, by saying only women's cooperatives, you know, only West Africa, we're actually limiting the impact that we could have, and that there are different types of structures and people that could also really benefit from this. So ended up sourcing from them, which was great. Still one of our suppliers and still working in Ghana too. And now we've actually diversified to where we are working in 11 different countries.
Wow.
So it's been a big process of expansion since then.
And has that original cooperative in Ghana rebuilt? Are you able to source from them again?
Yes, thankfully.
Wow.
Yeah. So we still source quite a bit out of Ghana.
And how has your, after having had that dilemma about whether to source from the family farm in Nicaragua, how has your sourcing philosophy changed as you've expanded now to 9 more countries?
Yeah, so we've really thought about, you know, how do we put together kind of different metrics of the different things that matter to us. So we're really big on women's empowerment. So how do we measure, you know, the the amount of women leadership and the ways that women are paid relative to men within the organization. We're really big on environmental sustainability. How do we measure, you know, the water usage and the sort of like impact on the soil? And how do we measure, you know, we want this to be lifting people out of poverty. How do we measure the income that people started with and the income that they're able to gain through our Moringa purchases? And so we've now put together sort of these scorecards, and we're able to assess, you know, both what is the quality of their Moringa, what quantities they can source from, but also how do they rate on the social and environmental metrics that we care about? And then we can prioritize sourcing from them due to how well they do on that.
Why is that? Maybe this is a stupid question. Why is that important? Why are you tracking all of that information?
Yeah, I think if we were just about, you know, hey, we're going to source like whatever Moringa, cheapest price we can get, and just, you know, sell it, that it wouldn't be a company that I wanted to work for. Because for me, it's not about just selling a food product. Like, I didn't come into this being like, I'm going to start a food company. I came into this saying, like, what is the impact that I can have on the world? And, like, what is the best way for me to create change? And something that I think about all the time is that, you know, most of the poorest people on the planet are farmers, and it's the people who grow food for the living. So if we can create more sustainable agriculture, we can pull people out of poverty at a massive scale. And so it's really exciting to me, and particularly because Moringa is such a climate smart crop. It's, you know, low water usage, doesn't require much fertilizer, very easy to grow and naturally regenerative, and you can harvest it 3 to 4 times a year. So I think it matters because of the type of business that we want to build.
I feel like some social entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs with a mission-driven company, some start with a problem that they're trying to solve and fit a company around that problem, and others build a company according to certain values and sort of find a problem along the way. Do you have any thoughts on that? How you did it? How you've observed other people do it? What makes sense? I mean, I feel like I get a lot of questions about, you know, how to find your idea or how to figure out which problem you want to solve. Obviously, the list of problems in the world is endless, and it can be really challenging to decide, okay, I'm going to focus on smallholder women farmers growing Moringa in West Africa. Can you just sort of talk us through that process for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to find something that you care about so much that you can't not do it. Because starting a company is really thankless for a long time, you know?
Like, I know.
You're going to get rejected by literally everyone. Like, the number of people who, particularly at age 22, having no experience in food or business or work, really, told me that this was a good idea was like pretty much zero. Even my parents were like, are you sure you want to do this? Like, you have a really nice day job. Why don't you just stick with that? They have changed their tune. My parents are very supportive. Thank you, parents. But it you just have to believe in it so much. And it has to be the thing that the idea that can't go away.
And then actually, let's talk about feedback a little bit, because I think this is also something that a lot of entrepreneurs, mission-driven or otherwise, experience negative feedback early on, how to decide what feedback to listen to and what not to, what to ignore, what to incorporate. There's a lot of noise, especially in the early days, especially when you don't know a lot and you're trying to figure it all out. Do you have a system? I would like to know your system. No, I mean, is there a way to sift through that and say, okay, this is an important piece of advice I should follow, and this is something that's outside of where I want to be spending my time, or it takes the company in a different direction than I want to go?
Totally. I mean, I'm my whole motto is like, be a sponge, like soak it all up. Like, I love listening to other people's thoughts and feedback, but I'm at the end of the day, like, I'm only going to squeeze out the drop that's right for me. And especially when people tell me no, like, I'm the type of person, like, if you tell me no, I'm going to say, well, screw you, I'm going to do it anyway, you know? And one thing that's been really fun, and it sounds slightly malicious, but I have a whole list of people that, like, rejected me over and over again, like especially investors who just like were like, nice project, little girl, like have fun. And now it's really fun to like be like, oh yeah, you know, we are now a multi-million dollar business with this Moringa product that you said was never going to be anything other than a lifestyle business. It's in 7,000 stores. So Maybe you should go buy one.
You just put them on your mailing list and send them updates, by the way.
Send them lots of updates. And it's so funny. Like the number of people have been like, wow, I didn't think you could do it. And I was like, well, we did. And I hope that, you know, the next time you see somebody who looks like me, like maybe believe in them a little more.
So what do you think that was? Because I mean, the statistics show that most startups don't survive and especially don't hit a multi-million dollar target. And especially in a business, for all of the reasons that you just said, a product that nobody had heard of, supply chains that are really challenging. What did you do right? What's your secret, or what would your advice be for somebody looking at a similar challenge, a business without a whole lot of legs and not a whole lot of positive feedback from investors or friends or whoever?
Yeah.
How should they proceed?
I'm a big fan of what I call charassment. It's like charming harassment.
I love it.
I'm very persistent in like investors, press, like sort of anyone who I think can help me. Not really, you know, taking no. If they say no and they mean no, like sure, then I'll just circle back in like, you know, 5 months instead of like 1 month. but continuing to update people and continuing to help them feel like they're a part of this journey and that they understand what's going on. And I have just like a huge mailing list of like all these people I've met. And, you know, many of them are people who have sort of said, this is interesting, but, you know, I'm not going to invest, or I'm not going to write about you, or I'm not going to whatever. And it's like, great. I'm just going to keep telling you all of our successes and keep like hustling to make this work. And then, you know, eventually you're going to see it and you're going to help me.
Yeah, I similarly have a list of people who are going to get emails from me once a month or a couple of times a year for the rest of their lives until they tell me to shut up and leave them alone, or they decide to at least be a little more open to what I'm proposing. I think the value of a polite, friendly, and impossible to get rid of person is amazing.
Well, and I think, you know, I find so often people are really scared of asking for what they want, which I fundamentally don't understand, because there's the worst thing that can happen is somebody can say no. And so it's, why not ask? Like, why not shoot for the moon?
Can you give us an example of an interaction you had, somebody who you
who
said no and said no and said no and eventually realized that they were wrong?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I have a couple examples. Our one of our first big breaks in the media was this reporter from Fast Company. And she kind of, you know, I kept pitching her and she's like, no, I don't think this is the thing. I don't think this is the thing. And it like was literally like 6 months of like pretty persistent, like, hey, and we just did this thing. And we just did this thing. And then finally she writes the story, and the story like totally took off and went viral for us. And that was like one of the first big things that I could send then to investors and send to buyers and be like, look, we're, you know, in a really respected publication. We're doing really well. Another one that's sort of fun is I worked with this amazing tech investor, Brad Feld. So he, you know, is really well known within the tech community and has this blog where he writes about all these different startup tips. And I was reading his blog and noticed he was writing about food. So had never met this man, but you know, it was easy to find his email address on the internet. Thank you, internet. And so sent him a cold email being like, hey, I've read your blog. I really enjoyed it. You know, I learned such and such from it. Also, I saw you writing about food. I just started this food company. Can I send you some samples? And he was like, sure. Like one line. I was like, okay, great. Send him some samples, you know, replied back. Hey, what'd you think? You know, I know you also do some investing. We're raising some funds right now. He's like, one line again, send me your deck. And I was like, okay. And so I sent it to him and he was like, sure, I'll put in 25K. And I was like, oh my God, really? So it's just amazing. Like, even when you don't think that, you know, these people are too important, they're never good, they don't have no interest in like something so small and insignificant. Sometimes they do.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. Featuring a variety of interactive displays, MOFAD encourages eaters of all ages to be curious about food. The museum currently operates MOFAD Lab, a 5,000-square-foot experimental space in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where Chow, making the Chinese-American restaurant, is currently on show until the end of March 2019. This exhibition celebrates the birth and evolution of Chinese-American restaurants, tracing their nearly 170-year history, and sparking conversations about food culture, immigration, and what it means to be American. It highlights the evolution timeline of Chinese-American restaurant menus, dating back to 1910, and also highlights a tasting section where participants get to enjoy tastings created by the country's most talented chefs who specialize in Chinese-American cuisine. Make sure you check out Chow while you still can. The exhibition closes at the end of March 2019. Check out MOFAD's tastings and extensive event calendar at mofad.org/events.
What was it like for you? What was easy? What was hard? What was surprising?
Yeah, I think the early days, it's really, really hard. If I could have, I would have tried to get a lot farther along before I went out and fundraised. But I think one of my challenges was coming out of Peace Corps, you're not exactly like bankrolled. I was making $75 a month in Niger and then, came back and was like, okay, great. I have no money. Like we need money to manufacture and to just get the product made and onto shelves. So I figured out pretty quickly that just had to get creative. So started with a Indiegogo crowdfunding campaign that was really successful. That gave us money to do our first manufacturing run. Then from there did like a Kiva loan, then did an equity crowdfunding campaign. So got some of our first investors and that gave us enough to really prove out that people will actually buy this product. And so we got into about 100 stores and were doing pretty well. And then, started to grow from there. And I think fundraising at that point was like just brutal. It was like, even though we were in stores, the number of people that wanted to take the risk were really, really low. So it was kind of like pulling teeth and it took a really long time. Then when we got the news from Whole Foods, they wanted to launch us nationwide. Like that was awesome. We raised another $500,000 in about 3 months. And then once we had hit, over the $1 million mark and we were about a $2 million company, then we were able to raise some venture capital money. And that was also relatively quick.
And there's been a fair amount of conversation about social impact and fundraising, especially venture or institutional capital, and that there can be some inherent conflict between those two. How have you navigated that? How have you made sure that the business still has that impact in mind as you're raising investment?
Yeah, I think it's an important question. One of the things for us that we did is we became a benefit corporation. So a lot of folks have heard of B Corp. It's kind of like a stamp of approval in the same way, like, you get certified organic or certified non-GMO. So we're that, but we're also a full benefit corporation, which means we actually changed our legal structure. So most corporations in the U.S. are C Corps, and we're officially this benefit corporation, and it basically legally means that we are both maximizing profits but also maximizing a stated impact. And so our impact is to use nutrient-rich plants like moringa as a tool to improve nutrition and livelihoods worldwide. And so we hold that on the same pedestal that we hold impact or that we hold profits. And that was a really good litmus test for us, for investors, to say like, hey, we are trying to maximize both and we want to make sure you know that we care about both.
And what did investors say when you told them that?
I would say by and large, a lot of them saw the value in it, because I think we've seen, particularly within the food industry, there's a lot of consumers that that, you know, maybe they don't go to the grocery store trying to buy the most sustainable product, but they care that there's transparent sourcing. They care, you know, that that product is doing something good for the world. Like, once they've bought it in particular, like, they will share it a lot more. It has a lot more virality if it is a mission-driven brand. And so, you know, we took some money from Kellogg, Kellogg's 1894 Capital, their venture arm, which, you know, I think if you had told me that, like, if 3 years ago that the maker of Frosted Flakes would be investing in a African Moringa company, I would have said that doesn't make sense. But they really care, and they see that, you know, Moringa and other, like, really sustainable natural food is the future of food. And so we've managed to get some pretty amazing investors who are really aligned and want to support us in our journey.
And have those kinds of companies, like Kellogg's or other potentially other companies that have invested or been involved, has that opened you up to sell Moringa as an ingredient into other people's manufactured products rather than just manufacturing it yourself?
Yeah. So we're finally at the point where we actually have a strong enough supply chain and, you know, have just built literally the largest, highest quality Moringa supply chain on the planet, and we have more than we need to supply just Cooley Cooley. So it's been really exciting that this year is the first year we're really able to turn our attention to, like, how do we also sell to other brands? How do we get Moringa on the menu in restaurants and, you know, get it, help other people understand the value of this plant and how they can use it in their products?
What are some of the most creative or surprising uses you've seen for Moringa?
We sell a lot to this bakery in LA, and they make, like, cookies with it, which is, like, you know, you think Moringa, you're like, oh, maybe smoothies, juices. No, but, like, baked goods. It has this beautiful green color. It looks kind of like matcha and adds kind of a similar level of, like, you know, a bit of earthiness to it, but tastes great when you combine it with the right things. And then, you know, adds the protein and the calcium and the iron and all these amazing nutrients to it.
And have you found that that's really, now that you're a little more established, you have a wider and more diverse set of customers than the people who walked by your table at the farmer's market?
Yeah.
Have you found that are your customers still motivated primarily by health, or what's bringing people to Moringa?
I would say primarily health. And the interesting thing about Moringa, and we didn't really know this until we launched nationwide, is that it's actually really important to a lot of different cultures. So we find among a lot of the Latino community here in the U.S., a lot of folks know it as a tool for weight management and sort of a natural treatment for diabetes, which is something that, you know, they are telling us. And then we start to see in the scientific literature, certainly there's not enough clinical trials, but there are some that show really promising results for helping to manage inflammation and reducing blood sugar levels. And so we hear from a lot of our customers that they really do see it as a part of their healthy diet. And I would think, you know, for a lot of people, it's something that gives them energy. And they're like, this just makes me feel really good and really energized, and I want to eat it every day.
Have people come to you for more information about how it grows, about the sourcing? Is that still top of mind, or has that gotten lost?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a big part of our brand. And I think particularly people who, you know, shop on our website and are, like, doing a little bit more research want to know more. And so we try to make sure we really tell the stories of the farmers we work with. Even to the extent we actually sent a video crew out to one of these villages that were, and this amazing farmer, Pirouette, who we're working with. And it was so funny because they brought in a drone, and, like, everybody in the village was like, what is this alien spaceship? And somebody actually threw a stick and knocked it to the ground. And it was terrifying because I was like, we are now on the hook for this multi-$1,000 drone. But thankfully, the drone was okay. And I think the guy learned, not an alien, just a flying robot.
One of the things that we've done with the Spice Company is try to kind of bring the feedback loop full circle. So going back to the farmers that we work with and saying, you know, here are some pictures of dishes that restaurants have made with your spices. On that note, what do the farmers that you work with think of this supply chain that you've built and the ways that Moringa is being used here?
I think they're so proud. Yeah, we do that in a similar way of like bringing back bars and, you know, or powders and everything, the like fully ready-made products, and just like they could just point to it and be like, we made that. That's awesome. It sort of feels like Halloween whenever we do that, because everybody's like, I want that. I want it.
Is it surprising to them? Is it weird that for them to think about how their products are being, not just being moved, but also being changed?
Yeah.
And how does that interact with their sort of sense of Moringa in their cultures?
Well, I think there's this really interesting thing that we've seen happen now across a few different communities where we source, where people are like, really, these Americans are growing Moringa? Like, maybe that's not as, you know, not as much of a weed as we thought, not as much of a poor person's crop as we thought. Maybe we should start eating more of it. And it's been cool to see the increase in people, you know, eating it in their own diet as well.
And so that has happened. You've seen.
Yeah, we've definitely seen it. And we've, you know, we haven't done as much like sort of quantitative research as I would like, but we've done surveys, and I would say by and large, people say that since they've started working with Moringa and have, you know, we've started working in their communities, they now eat a lot more Moringa at home as well.
What do you feel like Moringa, or the trend, the rising trend in Moringa here, what does that represent about where our food system is going, where the demand is heading, ways that people are shopping differently than they have in the past?
Yeah, I think at a macro level, I think there's an interesting trend towards like greens generally, that we all know, you know, we should be eating more greens and vegetables, but we don't necessarily have time to like stop and eat a salad. And I think that's where you see the rise of green juices, you know, green smoothies, that kind of thing. And then I think sort of within that, I think there is a real cognizance of the way we eat is really a vote, and it's a vote for the type of world that we want to live in. And so if you want to live in a, you know, sustainable, organic, like, you know, pesticide free world, that you're gonna vote with your dollars and buy food that's reflective of that.
What are some of the things that you're worried about over the next few years as your business continues to grow, as you potentially expand? What keeps you up at night?
A bunch of things. I think, you know, one of the things I do worry about is, I think, especially the, like, a lot of investors have now flocked into this food investment scene, and it's sort of a bit of a bubble. And it,
for your company specifically, or in general?
General, yeah. In general, sort of like investing in food has now gotten really hot, which is awesome. But it feels to me like a little bit of a bubble, that like valuations are getting so high and like things are getting too crazy, that I really don't want it to crash, because I think it is helping to create sort of the next wave of amazing plant-based foods. But there's so much activity happening that I just wonder the sustainability of it.
And how have your investors evolved along with the company, especially since you've brought in several different types of investors, crowdfunding yes. campaigns and grants from the Clinton Foundation? How has their perception of what you're doing changed, and what are their expectations as you grow?
Well, it was funny. I was sort of standing near one of our angel investors once, like one of the first people who invested us, and she didn't know I was there. I was like at this networking thing, and she was talking about me to somebody else. And so I got this like rare opportunity to hear about it from her perspective. And she was telling this other woman, you know, I invested in them, and I sort of thought it was like basically a charitable investment, that I was never going to see this money again, but they're making money. I was like, oh, thanks. Appreciate that. So they're thrilled. I think, you know, anytime you do angel investing, the chances the company goes out of business is pretty darn high. But I think they're pretty happy. And, you know, certainly the value they invested at has more than quadrupled since their investment. So that's been nice to have. And then for some of our newer investors, the company has grown quite a bit, and we actually did more in revenue last year than we did in our first 4 years of operating history combined. So we're growing fast and starting to see some real momentum behind Moringa. So keeping the investors happy, which is always good.
Yeah, and you're also riding this line as a public benefit corporation between a for-profit business, but also a service provider in a lot of ways to smallholder farmers. And you're in the process of getting a significant grant from the U.S. government.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about how that came about and how those two sides of the business support each other or are balanced?
Absolutely. So we had this kind of crazy thing where the Millennium Challenge Corporation, which is a program of the U.S. State Department, reached out to us and said, hey, do you want to build a supply chain for Moringa and Niger? And I was like, wait, I've been trying to do this for like so many years. What do you mean? Yes, yes, yes. Where do I sign up? How do I do it? And they had been looking at ways to boost economic development in Niger and looking at agriculture in particular, because it's a primarily agriculture-based society, and found that Moringa was a really climate-smart crop that could provide a great export crop. So we got kind of the first small tranche of that grant as part of this market assessment, where got to go back to Niger for the first time since being evacuated.
Wow, what was that like?
It was amazing. It was... I think everybody was like shocked that I actually came back. You know, you always say you're going to come back. And when I got evacuated, I was, I'll come back. And so everybody kept being like, you came back. You actually came back. And it was amazing to come back and not just come back to visit, but come back and be in a position of saying, you know, hey, I want to partner with you and I want to help you improve your livelihood and your community's livelihood, and like, let's work together to make this happen. So it's been a slow process. Government grants, I think, always are, but really, really excited about the future there.
What advice would you give to an early stage entrepreneur who's looking to fundraise, who needs money to operate a business, as does every business?
Yeah.
But fundraising can feel like a really challenging thing to do, especially if you've never done it before. There are these investors sort of floating in the sky, but how do you find them? How do you connect with them? How did you start that process? And what advice would you give to somebody looking to do the same?
I think one of the biggest things is to first figure out, like, what is the best possible sales story you can create with no money? And so for me, that meant, you know, we did the crowdfunding campaign. We have enough product that we can get it onto the shelves. And so I went, you know, every weekend was like demoing in Whole Foods, passing out samples, and then like tracking the numbers and like understanding, okay, what is our velocity on demo? What is our velocity off demo? Like, what is the units per store per week that we're selling? And then doing some very basic math and saying, hey, we're in 10 stores, but if we're in 100 stores, or if we're in 1,000 stores or 10,000 stores, like, this is how big this company could get. And also, let's think about, you know, what are some other products we could launch that maybe, you know, can have similarly economics, and layering all those in. And so, you know, you build a financial model, and like, you and the investor sitting next to you both know that like, most of this is made up. But if you have at least some little nugget of like a story behind why it could be actually accurate and actually possible, it's amazing how much people get that. And then the other thing I did was just like, you know, I didn't have a network. Like, at 22, my friends didn't even have jobs, let alone like money to invest. And so going to every single pitch event I could find and really just kind of telling the story, telling the possibility, and showing that opportunity. And it was slow, but got people on board.
Yeah. In the last few minutes, we transitioned to a lighter, rapid fire kind of personal question segment. I didn't warn Lisa about this. Hopefully she's prepared. No. So I'm just going to ask you a bunch of kind of fun, light questions. If you could master a skill overnight, what would it be?
Flying. Well, because I'm like always, or teleportation. Actually, change to teleportation. I'm always running like 5 minutes behind. I was actually early today here, so giving myself 10 points. Thanks.
Where would you teleport? Would you teleport anywhere exciting, or is it just to like,
I would like
spend less time visit, in transit?
Less time in a plane. Okay. I travel like almost every week. So if I could do that and just like, you know, be here, be there, be in Ghana hanging out with some of our farmers, and then be in New York schmoozing with some investors.
Sounds amazing.
It's great.
What did you eat for lunch as a kid?
As a kid, I ate a lot of peanut butter and jelly.
How old were you when you decided to become a vegetarian?
I was 12. And I also convinced my two younger sisters to be vegetarians.
I'm sure your parents were thrilled about that.
Oh my God, they were not happy. We made a deal. Technically, all of us are pescatarians because that was the one thing my mom was like, I need to make sure you get enough protein and I like fish. So you're going to eat fish. We're like, okay.
Do you still eat fish or have you?
I do. Okay. I do. It's sort of now it's my deal with my husband. So I keep making these deals.
What's the best meal you've ever had that cost less than $10?
Well, I love oatmeal and I make oatmeal with like all sorts of crazy superfoods. So I add in like chia seeds and bee pollen and almond butter and of course moringa. And goji berries, and then it's the best part of my day, and like it's way less than $10.
Do you have a particular style of making oatmeal or a way that you prepare it that it's, I don't know, some technique you've developed that's really particular?
I wish I could say it wasn't just putting it in the microwave and heating it up for 2 minutes, but it's putting it in the microwave.
It's more about the things that you mix
into it. More about the things that I mix into it. And I, you know, again, to the point of like always running a little bit behind, I'm like, trying to cram a lot of things in.
2 minutes in the microwave and then eat it as you walk towards the door kind of thing.
Totally.
Yeah. What's a song that you listen to when you're looking for some inspiration?
Oh, I just got a new one. I've got multiple. High Hopes by Panic at the Disco.
Amazing.
Got high hopes for a living. I'm like, oh yeah, that is my life.
What was it like hiring your first employee?
It was awesome. We had basically this internship program for a long time because we knew that we could pay people a little bit, but we couldn't actually hire anyone full time. And then we finally got enough money to like be able to hire someone. It was actually someone who had been interning with us for a couple months. And we're like, actually, you're awesome. And we want to keep you and we want you to stay. And he was thrilled and we were thrilled.
That's awesome. Lisa, it's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast. Thanks for joining us. Tell our listeners where they can find more about you and where they can find your products.
Yeah. So coolycoolyfoods.com, KULIKULIFOODS. We are also same at coolycoolyfoods on Instagram, on social. And I am at Lisa Curtis, LISACURTS. And we're available on Amazon. We're primable. And if you leave us a review, I will personally find you and give you a big hug.
Amazing. you've been listening to Why Food. You can contact us via our email address, whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can find me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram, Ethan at Burlap and Barrel. We're on Instagram at Why Food Podcast. Get in touch with us, make recommendations. Who should we talk to? Give us feedback, ask questions for future guests. Thanks to our amazing engineer, Matt, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.